Watching Olivia Dean frolic around the Brit stage with her signature timeless charm and effervescence, belting her absolute banger, which is currently angling to become maybe her first number one hit, Man I Need, got me thinking about another installment of my seven-level series, the seven levels of lead single. Something I've always been fascinated by as a student of pop music is the power of one single song. Forget the era, forget the album. Sometimes an artist's entire fate can change on the back of one truly transformative, perfectly timed lead single. But the inverse is just as compelling. If you choose badly, if you misread the room or misunderstand your own appeal, a lead single can have like the opposite effect. It can stall a career right as it's cresting. It can expose the limits of an artist's mythology. In extreme cases, it can downgrade you from a future legend to remember them long before anyone gets to hear the second offering from your forthcoming era. The lead single is two things at once, a pleasant appetizer for an album, but also a high stakes vote on who you get to be next. Welcome to my channel. Welcome back to my channel. My name is Zach. I'm a Swiftologist. I make thoughtful weekly videos about pop culture. And if you want to listen to my videos as a podcast, you can. Go to your audio platform of choice and find the Swiftologist podcast. Make sure to subscribe because I know you keep coming back. If you don't want to hear me pontificate about my intellectual compulsion behind the ranking, skip ahead to the time on screen for when the levels actually begin. For everyone else, let's talk about what a lead single actually is and how its power has changed and hasn't changed over time. Back in the day, in the era of physical singles and radio, the lead single was a very concrete thing. It was literally the first song released from an upcoming album, sent to radio weeks or months before the full project, and its job was really clear. Announce that an artist is back or has arrived for the first time, give the station something obvious to spin on their behalf, and convince retailers and the press that this era and this artist are worth caring about. In a world where access to listeners ran through a handful of gatekeepers, DJs, MTV programmers, record shops, that first song functioned as a pitch deck for a record. If it connected, budgets went up, TV bookings appeared, and the rest of the album campaign could breathe. If it didn't, the album was cudgeled at the starting line. On paper, it might seem like the streaming era broke this model. Artists now toss out songs constantly. Some are labeled buzz singles, some are random Lucy's, some are TikTok snippets that metastasize into hits almost by accident. Platforms push tracks into people's lives via algorithmic playlists and short-form video instead of these carefully scheduled radio premieres. Every few months, there's another think piece declaring the death of an album, pointing out that the average listener experiences music as a shuffled feed of tracks instead of 12 song statements. So in that world, it's easy to assume the old idea of a singular capital L lead single has collapsed into irrelevance, a relic of the jewel case era. But then came the surprise album drop. When Beyoncé released her self-titled visual album in 2013 with no traditional lead single, no months-long radio campaign, and no drip feed rollout, just a midnight upload and an internet aneurysm, it rewired what people thought was possible for a pop era. Suddenly, you didn't have to spend half a year begging playlists and radio to care. You could bypass the whole ritual and present the album as an event in itself. Other artists followed suit. Granted, you had to be big enough and have the momentum to do that, but the entire campaign could now arrive in one overwhelming package. So there's the final nail in the coffin for the lead single, right? If you can just wake up and drop the whole album, surely the pressure on one song is diminished. Yet somehow the concept refuses to die. Within the industry, people still talk about the lead when they're planning a campaign. Artists still agonize over the first taste of the album as a special, terrifying decision. Even in stand spaces, people instinctively know what counts. It's less about often the literal first song released and more about the track that actually introduces a new era and that everyone agrees is the thesis statement or a turning point. A song dropped a year before the album might get retroactively demoted to promo status, even if it's still on the album, while another becomes the accepted lead because it's the moment when the artist finally stands up and says, "This is who I am now," and everybody listens. Ironically, the surprise drop model ends up recreating this logic. Yes, sometimes the album arrives in one overwhelming midnight deluge with no obvious lead, but the morning after, the system starts picking favorites. One track gets plucked for radio servicing, this one goes on the big editorial playlist, one might become a TikTok sound, and that's the one that you're gonna perform on TV. Most people don't live with the album as a complete body of work for very long. They binge it in full once or twice, and then their listening narrows down to a handful of songs that escape the track list and circulate on their own. From that handful, one song almost inevitably becomes the era's representative, the de facto lead, chosen after the fact rather than before. In some ways, the blurrier definition is kind of a blessing for artists. It gives them multiple shots or even the ability to A/B test a vibe with a single before fully committing to a new era. I don't necessarily recommend that creatively. I think it can dilute your vision, but strategically, it does mean that you aren't always betting an entire era on one roll of the dice. If a first attempt lands with a dull thud, a second or third pre-release track might become the lead once everyone sees what actually resonates. That flexibility can be the difference between having your budget cut and getting a proper push. The right song catching at the right moment can unlock a more expensive video or a better playlist placement or bigger live opportunities. So I will concede the formality of the lead single has softened. There's more trial and error, more side quests, and more songs that don't even resolve into albums at all. But that doesn't mean the role itself and the purpose of a lead single has weakened. If anything, I think the stakes of the lead single have truly intensified. On the audience side, we have more options and less patience. The ceremony of sitting by the radio for a premiere is gone. Most of us encounter new music as one tile among hundreds on a New Music Friday carousel. That hyperabundance makes your first impression brutal. If you are only going to get one song from an artist into the average person's life, that song now carries a lot more narrative weight than a meticulously sequenced album ever will. A brilliant lead can create enough momentum so the album feels like an event before anyone has even heard the second track. A misjudged one can make a project feel dead on arrival, the same week that it's announced, in a culture that will move on by Monday. So the lead single is less rigid, but it's more symbolically loaded. You have more chances to get it right, but if you do manage to hit the bullseye, or if you miss it spectacularly, the consequences travel further than ever. A lead single can birth a career, upgrade a career, trap, or suffocate one. Because the definition of a lead single has kind of gotten a little bit blurrier in recent years, in this video, I'm not ranking by quality or sales strictly, so much as by what they do. How does this particular lead single, this first taste of a new era, affect an artist's position on the chessboard of the industry? Does it open a door? Does it close one? Does it build a world? Does it leave a hole where the world should be? A lead single can completely start a career. Think of the way Baby One More Time introduced an era of precision-produced Swedish pop to the American market in a way that we're still hearing today, almost 30 years later. But lead singles can also be too big. There's a whole subgenre of hit lead singles that ruined eras precisely because the song was too big, too misleading, or too bound to a gimmick to let the artist grow beyond it. So that's how I approach creating my rubric today. Feel free to disagree or tweak my formula in the comments for your own amusement. Level one of lead singles is the career killer. Career killers are lead singles that actively damage momentum and derail the trajectory of an artist who, on paper, maybe should have been fine. These songs are emblematic of why a culture has moved on from an artist. Yes, they fail to generate excitement for an era, but they also retroactively force people to assess whether that era should exist at all. A normal flop is a bad outfit. A level one flop is getting escorted out of the building. Take Woman's World by Katy Perry. This was billed as her grand, glossy return to the arena after years in flop mode, the moment that she would remind people of the 2010 to 2013 run that made her unavoidable. Instead, it instantly exposed how far the ground had shifted underneath her. The timing was horrible, first and foremost in 2024. The song itself felt like a relic from the girl boss industrial complex, and the video was really tonally strange, cheap-looking and leering, faux feminist, and it became a cultural talking point without ever becoming a truly successful song. While failing to get listened to, it provoked think pieces, backlashes, and memes, most of which weren't about the music at all and certainly weren't flattering towards Katy Perry. The discourse it inspired eclipsed its chart performance, which is the nightmare scenario. Your comeback single becomes a symbol of everything people are glad they left in the early 2010s. Rather than convincing anyone that Katy's resurgence was necessary, it definitely reminded the wider public why her moment was already over. The 143 campaign was literally dead before it started. Let me give you a man's example, Justin Timberlake's Filthy. This is a man whose 2000s run was essentially the blueprint for the modern male pop star, returning in 2018 with an album allegedly about reconnecting with his roots, which are, pause, we'll wait. What we got as the lead was a glitchy funk track that sounded like a dad cosplaying his own 2006 relevance. The song itself is not the worst thing ever recorded, but it feels incredibly try-hard, like an AI prompt for a sexy Justin Timberlake song. And it also sits at a really weird angle to Man of the Woods, which was the era he was trying to market as earthy and authentic. The sonic and visual disconnect shows that a career killer is as much of a branding error as a musical one. Coming after years of cultural eye-rolling about his Super Bowl controversy with Janet Jackson and his treatment of women in general, the last thing he could afford was a lead single that made him look more out of touch, and yet that's exactly what Filthy did. It converted maybe he could have one great era left into him into, oh, we're done here. Case closed. This one's gonna make a lot of gays mad. Christina Aguilera's Not Myself Tonight is one of the bleakest case studies because you can almost see the fork in the road that it represents. Coming after Stripped and Back to Basics, Christina had proven that she could reinvent herself, take risks, and still be a semi-central pop figure. But then in 2010, she stepped back into the ring with a lead single that sounded like a lab-grown response to Lady Gaga's emergence instead of an evolution of her own instincts. The song is busy and really oddly constructed. The video is strange, and the entire Christina goes electro-futurist angle arrived just as Lady Gaga was defining that lane far more compellingly. I know the Bionic, the album this single represents, has its shooters, but girl, seriously, it was more than a flop. It precipitated a permanent reclassification of Christina's position in the culture. She was moved very quickly into nostalgia legacy act status, someone the industry respects for past glories but no longer treats as a present tense force. When you compare that to Britney Spears, who debuted at the same time and still managed to eke out at least 5 more years of real hits and pop cultural relevance, it's hard not to see Not Myself Tonight as the wrong term she never recovered from. Let's pivot to some more recent examples of softer career killer singles that may not annihilate a superstar's imperial phase overnight, but definitely cap their potential. Selena Gomez, Call Me When You Break Up is for me one of these. Selena's entire pop authority is rooted less in her raw talent, obviously, she's not a great singer, than in being the face of a specific mid-2010 sound. Moody, minimal, mid-tempo, Tumblr coded, that era defined a certain kind of cool, and by extension, she became associated with it. When she attempts a return framed as a step into maturity by releasing a 2-minute acoustic ballad featuring the Gen Z it girl at the moment with a vertical music video shot in bed, it reads as low effort. For someone whose place in the hierarchy was already best supporting pop girl at best, this kind of shrug of a lead single nudges her further away from necessity and closer to she's just a famous person, not a musically central artist. Shawn Mendes's YYY operates in a similar register. For years, Shawn coasted on being the dependable, hunky, slightly earnest male pop presence. Acoustic songs with big hooks, just enough presence to justify a Calvin Klein campaign. The implicit deal here, though, was that even though these songs might not be genre-defining, they kind of feel like something you might want to hear at a festival or in a spin class, and accompanied by something gorgeous to look at. When he came back with a sleepy John Mayer cosplay ballad, it revealed that he had fully run out of passes at making boring music. Even soft launching his potentially fruity narrative around his personal life couldn't obscure how little there was to hold on to here musically. Then there is Solar Power, which might be one of the most brutal examples of how a lead single can misfire in the streaming era. Lorde's post-melodrama absence generated an enormous amount of pressure. She doesn't live online, she takes her time, and she has been positioned as this generational songwriter, which means that every lead single and comeback has to do a lot more work than just introducing an album. It's answering the question of, is Lorde still relevant? Solar Power is a breezy, ironically detached ode to nature and unplugging, released at a time when most listeners were still stuck inside and climbing out of a global pandemic. The tone was off, the timing was off, and crucially, the song is far from the precise, emotionally knife-sharp pop of melodrama. The gap between what people wanted, a new emotional thesis for being 20-something in a period of chaos, and what they got, which was a barefoot smirk on the beach, made this underperformance a referendum on Lorde's relevance. Because she gave us so little else to hold on to publicly, the failure of this one song to connect became the story of the entire era. If the lead single doesn't hit in a context like that, there is no backup narrative to cushion the blow. All of these songs live on level one because of what they did to their artist's position. As you can see, they really vary in quality, but generally, none of them are good songs. They lowered ceilings and tightened boxes. Let's go into level two, False Starts. False Starts are lead singles that arrive with all the fanfare of a new chapter, a big visual and a rollout and a lot of language about this is the most me I've ever been, that then get abandoned or paved over in retrospect because they just didn't hit. They don't kill a career, but they loudly promise an era that never shows up. The album swerves in a different direction, another track ends up becoming the focal point, or the whole campaign just evaporates. These are the songs that fans retroactively demote to promo single, even though clearly at the time everyone was betting on them. Yummy by Justin Bieber is a prime example of this. After years of public mess and patchy releases, there was a genuine opening for a grown-up recalibration of who Justin Bieber was, something that acknowledged his chaos and came back with a point of view, something like Sorry. Instead, we got Yummy, a nursery rhyme sex song, welded to one of the most exhausting promotional blitzes of the 2020s, the infamous Scooter Braun Everything Everywhere method. TikTok challenges, streaming tutorials, shameless please keep the song on repeat overnight instructions turned this whole campaign into a visible exercise of desperation. Justin literally begging for Yummy to go number one only to still lose to Roddy Ricch was bad enough. What's worse is that the song itself wasn't even worth the humiliation. It's not a classic. It doesn't say anything new about him. It didn't even launch a compelling album. Changes was an era pitched around a single direction that nobody really wanted, including eventually the artist. Lady Gaga's Perfect Illusion is fascinating as a level two lead single because you can see the intent so clearly, but also see it's misfiring. Coming off of art pop, Gaga needed to prove that she could recenter herself, less chaos and more musicality, remind people of what she was really good at. On paper, a raw rock disco lead makes total sense for Lady Gaga, but Perfect Illusion is a strangely shrill one-note scream-along that feels yanked from a different project entirely. It certainly doesn't feel in tune with the album that it's attached to, Joanne, that is more country rock and piano ballad, Americana-ish shtick. The British-accented pogo stick chorus of Perfect Illusion doesn't belong here. It's too weird and too boring at the same time, which is the worst combination a lead single can have and very un-Gaga-esque. This song made absolutely no noise and the radio moved on. The entire Joanne era was basically saved by Million Reasons becoming popular after her Super Bowl performance. This was a dangerous, shaky move. When people think about Joanne now, they think about the cowboy hat and maybe that ballad, Million Reasons, not this song. This is a great distillation of a false start lead single, announcing a direction that the artist and the audience mutually decide was never the plan. Ariana Grande's focus is one of the rare false starts that feels almost healthy because what she was doing was listening to the feedback. Coming off of My Everything, she had really perfected the horn-driven Max Martin banger. Problem low-key broke her out of the Kia asylum, so Focus is a beat-for-beat remake of that with a more obnoxious hood and a more intense visual and a concept that boils down to, remember how much you liked that last song? I got something else for you. I like Focus personally as fluff, but as a thesis statement for a new era, it reads either as an extension of My Everything or redundant. Listeners definitely didn't hate this song, they just didn't resonate with it as a new promise. Crucially, Ariana decided, you know what? I'm gonna cut my losses. I won't double down. She scrapped the entire original album title, Moonlight, that accompanied Focus, and pivoted the campaign and came back with Dangerous Woman, a slow-burning, guitar-based mid-tempo that opened into one of her most varied and confident records. The decision to effectively demote Focus after the fact is what keeps it at level 2 instead of sliding into level 1. It's a misfire, but it was reversed. Then there's Me, a song that manages to be both a false start and in some ways a mini career humiliation ritual. After the dark and defensive pivot of Reputation, Taylor Swift had a real opportunity to reintroduce herself as a grown woman who had survived a public flogging and emerged sharper. Instead, her first move into the Lover era was an explosion of yuckiness with Brendon Urie, complete with Spelling Is Fun and visuals that looked like they were from The Secret Life of Pets 2. I'm serious, fans actually thought that this was a soundtrack song for that children's movie because it felt so estranged from what she does best. Me is childish, cloying, and catastrophically written by Taylor Swift standards. None of her strengths are here. No narrative detail or emotional nuance or venom are present. Over time, Lover has been rescued by tracks like Cruel Summer, which retroactively make Me look like an awkward, wrong-colored puzzle piece. In the lore, it's a false start for sure. The version of the era she initially tried to sell that she quickly downplayed and wrote out of the story when everyone agreed that it was beneath her. Lucky by Halsey is a smaller entry in this category. After a pretty long pause from a conceptual album cycle and a series of interesting creative swings, Halsey opted to come back with a track built around interpolating Britney Spears. That is a high bar to set for yourself. In a world where nostalgia mining is an easy route to streaming attention, you can see the logic there. But the problem is that Lucky, Halsey's version, never justifies its existence artistically. It doesn't transform the source material. It just takes the chorus and changes the words. It doesn't say anything urgent about who Halsey is as an artist. And it also leans heavily on recognition instead of craft. Worse, Britney Spears herself reacted quite negatively to this, kicking up a cloud of discourse about sampling and exploitation that immediately overshadowed whatever the song was trying to communicate. Every false start lead single is a little erosion of trust, one more reminder that the audience is willing to sample almost anything, but you only get so many chances to convince them that this is who you really are now. All right, level 3. I like to call these the empty hits. Lead singles that technically work, they chart or they stream or, you know, they're popular on the radio, but they leave nothing behind. They don't build anything. They don't deepen an artist's identity, and they don't even tell you much about what the album they're representing is going to sound like. They're just, you know, there, doing numbers, taking up space. On the surface, I think these songs are success stories. They debut high, and they haunt retail jobs. But if you ask, what was that era about, and all you can think of is the hook of this lead single, that's a level 3 problem. A level 3 empty hit is a billboard outside the neighborhood the house is in. You see it, the colors are kind of nice, but it doesn't make you want to turn into the neighborhood. It gives you a moment, not a world. These songs are in an awkward limbo where the artist absolutely wanted them to be earth-shattering statements and the audience just kind of went, well, okay, we'll listen to it, but we're not going to remember it or care about it. And that's the difference between an empty hit and a safe bet, which we'll get to later. Safe bets are modest by design. They're not trying to change your life. Empty hits have the budget and the ambition of a real event, but when the dust settles, all they've done is give everyone a new song to let autoplay. They still fail at the one job that actually matters for a lead single: make people want to live in your era with you for a while. It's musical fast food. You feel entertained, but there's no aftertaste, no story. A song like Havana by Camila Cabello is massive and instantly recognizable, and yet for most people, the Camila era doesn't really exist as a coherent thing in their heads. Easy on Me is a mammoth Adele ballad with record-breaking radio stats, but still, it fails to give 30 a distinct silhouette beyond more of the same Adele that we know. Attention by Charlie Puth, Houdini by Dua Lipa, It's Okay, I'm Okay by Tate McRae, and Holy by Justin Bieber all had every advantage in the world: the name recognition, the big budget behind them, playlist support, tried and tested formulas. And yet, if you really pressed the average listener and you played them these songs and you said, what era are each of these songs from? You get a blank stare. Level 3 singles can keep your career ticking over, but they don't move you forward. These lead singles sell you easy listening and nothing else. Level 4 is where we meet our safe bets. Safe bets are lead singles that do exactly what they're supposed to do and nothing more. They don't reinvent the wheel or yank a pop star up or down the ladder. They just extend their reign a little bit. This is stability in song form. When a label picks a safe bet for a lead single, what they're really saying is, we know what works for you, let's just do that again. The thing about safe bets is that unlike empty hits, they're not pretending to be more important than they are. are. These singles keep you on the radio, they keep your ticket sales healthy, and they give you something reliable and interesting to open the tour with. They rarely become the defining moment of a career, but they don't need to. This is like the connective tissue between bigger swings. Miley Cyrus's Midnight Sky is a really good example of a safe bet deployed strategically. Not the biggest hit in the world, but by the time Miley released it, she'd spent years ping-ponging between very extreme incarnations. Banger Shot Value, Dead Pets Chaos, Malibu Folk Girl, Random Features, Long Silences. There was a sense that Miley had a lot of talent and potential, but no stable identity as an artist. Midnight Sky doesn't change who she is or insist on a specific version of her, but it chooses one of her modes that is familiar to people, that rock-leaning thing, the raspy voice, the messy glam, and it really commits to the bit. The song itself is catchy, it's well-built, and there's enough Stevie Nicks cosplay there to justify a duet with her that brings more attention to the album cycle, and it did pretty respectable numbers. It sold Plastic Hearts as a coherent project, and it didn't overpromise on a world she couldn't deliver. It was her first well-charting lead single in a while. It's a safe bet in the best sense. Manchild for Sabrina Carpenter functions in a very similar way. Short and Sweet saw an explosive growth for her in the year of the pop girl, with hit after hit, multiple album tracks outperforming lead singles from other artists. How do you top that? Well, perhaps the idea is a lateral move. More of the same, please. She doesn't need a reality shifter at this point in her career, because the life cycle of a pop album in 2026 is so much shorter than it once was. Back in the day, she could have ridden the Short and Sweet high with the deluxe version and nothing else for 2 years. But she needed to maintain her relevance, I think, and keep a placeholder while she figures out what comes next for her artistically after Short and Sweet and Man's Best Friend. Manchild is exactly that placeholder. It's a cheeky, hooky pop song that is a natural extension of Espresso-era Sabrina. Vocally, lyrically, and visually, it doesn't push her into new territory, but it confirms that there is a sustainable lane that has a little bit more juice left in it here. I think in a couple of years, people will struggle to differentiate the singles on Man's Best Friend and Short and Sweet as distinct eras from each other, and that is the point of a safe bet. It extends visibility without compromising your shine. You may shriek at this next mention, but hear me out. Katy Perry's Roar was a safe bet single. In a vacuum, this is one of her biggest hits. It's enormous. One of the biggest songs of the 2010s. It has a stadium-ready hook, and it is, you know, the default cheesy pop song. But think about what it actually did for Katy Perry's career. Did it transform her? No. It extended her imperial phrase a bit through the Prism era, tacking another giant chart monster onto the run of Teenage Dream, Firework, California Girls, E.T., Last Friday Night. But if you took Roar off the Prism album, we certainly wouldn't be viewing that era as a continuation of an imperial phase. Roar doesn't introduce a new persona or a sound. It's the logical endpoint of what she'd already been doing. Empowerment slogans, bright colors, animal metaphors, poptimism. It's very effective as a song and almost completely neutral as a career pivot. And that's why it's a safe bet and not a reality shifter, despite being a massive hit. Let's talk about a man for a second. Aperture for Harry Styles is interesting because it shows what a safe bet looks like when you're at a very high level of fame. Harry has long since crossed into a space where style, imagery, and vibe are just as important for him as his music. His post-boy band career is built on very carefully curated aesthetics, the suits, the hair, the I'm a rock star, but I'm a polite rock star persona. A lead single like Aperture gives him permission to keep doing that. It is not the most daring song he can make, but it does kind of let him continue selling concert tickets and fashion campaigns and a general sense of tasteful melancholy without forcing people to renegotiate who he is or what he means to the culture. The track slots very seamlessly into the Harry Styles cinematic universe. It demands nothing new from him or from us. Jealous Type is Doja Cat's safe bet. After a very trying time of antagonizing her own fan base, pivoting sounds a lot, and testing the limits of how bratty and experimental she can be while still functioning as a hitmaker, there was a real risk that she might drift too far into divisive niche territory. A song like Attention leaned harder into hip-hop, Paint the Town Red reminded everyone that she could still dominate, but Jealous Type was the safety harness. It slides back into her most radio-friendly instincts. Sticky hooks and conversational verses, a beat that flatters her flow without distracting from it. It doesn't provoke, it doesn't alienate, and it also doesn't expand who Doja Cat is. It just reminds radio programmers, playlist editors and the industry, and also casual listeners, that if you need something that will replay well and offend no one, she's still a reliable option. That's pure level four energy. The important thing about safe bets is that they're not cowardly. Used at the right moment, they are a smart move. Not every era can or should hinge on a wild reinvention. Careers, especially in a song-centric ecosystem, need maintenance. And the risk is when safe bets become a default rather than a strategy. One or two safe bets between bigger swings can keep you afloat for years, but a decade of them in a row, suddenly you're background music. All right, we're getting further up the ladder. We're at level five, the era solidifiers. Meet level five. These songs perform well, but more importantly, they lock a whole project into focus. They sound like the album, they look like the album, and they feel like the core emotion of an era. You don't need the album's press release to explain what it's gonna do, because this song is the album's press release. Even if the general public eventually attaches themselves to a different track, this is the one that fans will point to and say, that's the blueprint. Von Dutch is maybe the most obvious recent example, the second Charlie starts snarling about it's okay to just admit that you're jealous of me, you understand Brat in its entirety. The song is deliberately abrasive, bratty in the literal sense, and deeply uninterested in relatability. It announces a world where taste is a weapon and being annoying is a brand. The pop girl here isn't asking to be liked, she assumes that you're already inspired by her. The visual language of the music video, the paparazzi shot aesthetic, the leather jackets, the blacked out sunnies, all signal at the album's eventual styling and creative direction. So even if 360 or Apple or Guess ended up being the bigger hit, I think that Von Dutch is the thesis. If you don't get this, you don't get Brat. Jade's Angel of My Dreams plays a similar role for a different kind of artist. At her first real swing at a solo career post Little Mix and the last of the girls to release a solo project, the stakes were really high. She needed to prove that she could exist outside the group's nostalgia bubble with a point of view. Angel of My Dreams does that by landing dead center in the lane she wants, clubby, darkly camp, queer adjacent pop that still feels accessible to the casual listener. It's not trying to be the biggest song in the world, but it definitely wants to show you what a Jade solo era feels like. The production and the writing and the styling all cohere around this idea of her as a cool, slightly unhinged friend that you meet at 1 a.m. and follow into trouble. The song does a lot of thematic work with the music video as well. It charts her rise into fame and her relationship to the public eye, while also still being a very weird artistic statement and out there and outlandish in its construction. It has several hooky moments that make it a perfect pop song. This is the track that people will think of when they try to explain who Jade is as a solo act, no matter what charts go on to reflect in the future. Can we have a moment for Tate McRae? Greedy is the textbook 5A solidifier for a pop girl who is moving up the ladder in real time. Tate McRae already had success by the time Greedy rolled around, but there was definitely a question about whether she was just going to be a TikTok artist who could dance or a next generation pop star. Greedy answered that perfectly. The hockey rink video, the choreography, the vaguely Y2K familiar Ryan Tedder production, all of this is designed to sell Tate McRae as someone who can carry a full-blown pop era. This is her first real hit that transcended terminally online teens. The rest of the project, Think Later, for better or worse, lives in the shadow of this energy. I would like to go back to my good sis, Selena Gomez. Selena Gomez, good for you, did heavy lifting for Selena in 2015. Up until Revival, her discography was a bit of a Frankenstein monster. Disney remnants, The Scene, EDM flirtations, just generic radio Disney fodder. Good For You is the first time everything clicked. It's minimal and sultry and adult in a way that doesn't feel forced. The song finally gives her a sonic home, breathy, low-key, and slightly moody, definitely more about the texture and the effect of her voice rather than the sound and the tone of it. This song stabilized her brand and gave her something more substantial to be than just a famous woman who releases songs sometimes. Diet Pepsi is a newer example, but it's already the archetypal Addison Rae single. Everything about it, how it winks at you, how it's self-aware, how it has this kind of Americana bimbo persona, zeroes in on what makes Addison interesting. She is not trying to be the capital P pop vocalist. She's just trying to be the purest expression of an internet native, hyper-feminine, terminally online pop girl. Diet Pepsi leans into this with glee. The song is fizzy and synthetic and a little bit empty in a way that feels intentional instead of accidental. It lays out a whole aesthetic world, sonic and visual, that has been reflected across the subsequent album campaign and tour. This is exactly what an era solidifier does. It clarifies who you are as an artist. Drew Barrymore is the blueprint for SZA's Control era. The entire project is about being messy and insecure, horny, delusional, self-aware, but this song really distills all of that into 3.5 minutes. The production is lived in and warm, the melodies wander through like a house party, and the lyrics definitely sound like they were ripped from her notes app at 3 a.m. It's not the biggest hit on the album by any stretch, but it's the purest statement of intent. When people talk about how Control changed the sound of R&B and the language around 20-something womanhood, it's the emotional blueprint that was laid down on Drew Barrymore they are referring to. Let's go niche for a second. We'll talk about Rush by Troye Sivan. This is his most convincing offering as a pop star. Before this, I think that Troye's place on the ladder was slightly undefined. He was important for what he represented, an openly gay boy in pop music, but not musically indispensable. Rush changes that by committing to a sweaty, horny club kid hedonism. The song is built for bodies in motion, and the video is styled in an unapologetically gay way that would have been unthinkable even a decade ago at this level of pop. It's a declaration that this is what Troye Sivan looks and feels like now. He is gay, he is physical, and he's clubbing. Level 5 singles aren't necessarily the most commercially dominant songs in their ecosystems, and they're not always the neatest fit for radio, but they are the songs that, when you zoom out, define the era in people's minds. They give you a world to step into, and in a landscape where people only ever meaningfully engage with one or two tracks per project, that clarity is extremely powerful. All right, we're at level 6. I've mentioned it briefly, but these are the reality shifters, lead singles that permanently move an artist into a higher weight class. Before an artist has a reality shifter, you have a pop act with some hits, maybe even a very famous one, or you have a niche genre artist that is well respected by their peers, but not necessarily a star. After a reality shifter, the artist operates in a different tier entirely. Bigger venues, bigger budgets, higher expectations, a new level of cultural relevance. These tracks rewrote what was possible for the person who sung them. Justin Bieber's What Do You Mean is a great example of a reality shifter. It not only heralded a new era of commercial success for him, it helped resolve some narrative issues his persona had taken on in the public eye. Before Purpose, Justin's public story was less future legend and more troubled menace to society. A lot of people had decided decided he was just this washed up child star addicted to tabloid chaos. What Do You Mean had to do two things at once: sell him as a grown man and make his presence on pop radio feel inevitable again. It worked. The song debuted at number one on the Hot 100, his first ever Hot 100 number one as a lead artist. It also helped define the sound of mid-2010s pop. It's trot pop, muted, breezy, slightly melancholy, but crucially, it sounded adult. It's flirtatious, it's not needy, and it's cool. The lyrics are clearly read as being kind of about Selena Gomez, which tied into drama at the time, which definitely ignited more interest in the both of them. But this shift towards adult contemporary, combined with the scale of this campaign, there was a huge celebrity countdown, high-profile performances, and the numbers that it pulled rehabilitated his image and opened the door for Sorry and Love Yourself to turn Purpose into his true imperial phase. What Do You Mean is the switch flip moment between a child star and a credible main pop boy. This is one of my favorite examples. Espresso is that moment happening for Sabrina Carpenter at hyperspeed. Up until 2024, Sabrina was a very typical mid-tier pop girl story. Minor Disney background, a handful of nice but anonymous singles, a relatively successful breakout record that didn't really bring her anywhere new. There was a sense that she lived somewhere between supporting pop girl and internet diva without a clear route out. Espresso detonated her limbo. It's not just a hit. It's an omnipresent, genuinely inescapable pop song that arrived pre-packaged with a new language. That's that Mi Espresso instantly became a meme. You know I Mountain Dew it for you. People who never cared about her started quoting it, remixing it, adding it into their daily lives. The song's success immediately translated into structural upgrades for Sabrina, top tier festival slots, way more budget and ambition for the Short and Sweet album campaign, and Grammy visibility. Suddenly, Sabrina wasn't being spoken about in the same breath as Madison Beer or Zara Larsson. She's now being ranked against Olivia Rodrigo and Billie Eilish. The reality shifter gives more than one good era. It repositions you in the cultural conversation going forward. Flowers performed a surgical revival on Miley Cyrus's career. She has never been irrelevant. She's too iconic for that. But her post-bangers output was erratic, with brief flares of interest surrounded by a sense that the industry still didn't know what to do with her. Flowers is her first true, clean, global number one since the early 2010s, spending 8 weeks atop the Hot 100 in the US and becoming her first song to surpass a billion streams on Spotify. It's also, crucially, the rare Miley single that works for absolutely everyone. TikTok, radio, your aunt, Grammy voters, critics. The song wins record and best pop solo performance at the Grammys, finally aligning the critical and commercial narratives in her favor. After Flowers, the possibility space for Miley shifted. She is an artist that you can imagine doing a legacy tour or a Vegas residency that people would actually show up for. For Dua Lipa, Don't Start Now made her the face of the decade's first big disco revival. She already had success with New Rules and IDGAF, but there was still a sense that she was interchangeable with all the other playlist baddies. Don't Start Now blew up. It arrived right at the crest of the pre-pandemic club nostalgia wave and became a long-tail smash, top 10 in dozens of countries, multi-platinum, a streaming monster, and the vanguard of future nostalgia, an era that dominated the 2020s pop landscape. The reality shifter test is, does this single make you a reference point instead of an also-ran? It definitely did that for Dua Lipa. Bad Romance is almost too obvious to explain, but it's cheating not to. Coming after the already huge debut era of the fame with Poker Face and Just Dance, Gaga could have easily stayed in safe hit territory, but Bad Romance ain't safe. It is a bizarre, intricate, unhinged moment, and the visuals are a full-blown horror couture. And yet, it becomes a multi-country number one, earns Grammys, and settles almost instantly into the canon as one of the great pop singles of this century. Narratively, it really helped cement Gaga as an auteur. Before that, you could argue she was just kind of like a shock jock with some big songs, but after Bad Romance, that argument went to hell. The entire fame monster at Mini Era is built on the aesthetic and emotional logic of this track. She has hits, but now she has a worldview. That's a level up. I was really torn between including We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together and Shake It Off, but I have chosen Shake It Off because Shake It Off is Taylor using a reality shifter as a bridge between genres. Up through Red, she was still technically a country artist who had one foot in pop. There was a real question, especially in Nashville, about whether she could survive abandoning that identity or whether she'd fizzle out competing directly with pop girls who already owned the terrain. Shake It Off said she was absolutely a force to be reckoned with. It debuted at number one on the Hot 100 and spent weeks in the top 10, lodging itself immediately into the weddings, birthdays, graduations canon alongside songs like I Got a Feeling and Single Ladies. It's not that deep, and that's kind of the point. It's a deliberately broad, silly, mass appeal anthem that's still intelligent, which scrubs her image of country specificity and reintroduces her as someone your entire extended family can scream along to in a minivan. More importantly, it opened the gate for 1989, which remains her most globally coherent pop era. Formation is the strangest reality shifter here because its intention was completely different to all of these other songs. Its impact is structural in Beyoncé's career rather than chart-based, dropped with a visual that references Hurricane Katrina, police brutality, Southern Black history, and her own Creole roots. Formation really marks a moment that Beyoncé wanted to stop playing the game that everyone else was playing and create for herself in her own lane. The song and the video sparked intense debate, praise, outrage, essays, think pieces about politics and pop, and her role as a very public Black Southern woman. It really became a decade-defining work, and it set the tone for Lemonade as a full-blown visual album that fused the personal and the political into one narrative arc. Before Formation, Beyoncé was already a main pop girl. She'd been central for over a decade, but she had largely avoided really explicit political commentary in her singles. With Formation, she understood that she had the hits, and she wanted to enter a different category, being a capital AAA artist whose every move is read as a deliberate cultural statement. You don't get that by chasing hits. Post-formation, she has stopped functioning like a singles artist at all. The solo projects that follow, Lemonade, Homecoming, Renaissance Part 1 and 2, are conceived as albums, films, and worlds. She's now pretty much an albums-only auteur who can afford to ignore radio success entirely. That is also a tier shift. The commonality between all of these reality shifters is that they flipped a narrative switch. Sometimes that goes in tandem with chart success, but it's also possible to shift an artistic reality without a number one. All of these artists' leverage, expectations, and relationship to the system changed after they had a reality shifter. This is the power of a really great lead single. All right, level 7. The one and done. Level 7 is the apex of the ladder because you literally have one shot at getting here and most people miss it. The origin myth single. A level 6 song upgrades you within a system that already knows your name, but a level 7 song is the moment the system learns your name and reorganizes itself around it. These are debuts or solo debuts that are so definitive, everything the artist does afterwards is an extension of that first idea or an argument with it. They hardcope an archetype for an artist. Baby One More Time is the most famous example. When it dropped in 1998, Britney wasn't a pop icon. She was a relatively unknown teenager from Louisiana who happened to be the vehicle for a Max Martin song. Within months, the track had gone to number 1 in at least 18 countries, sold millions of copies, and anchored an album that 20 years later is still treated as the spark that reignited teen pop at the turn of the millennium. The sound she created with Max Martin, that Swedish-American pop sound, was the template for an entire wave of late 90s, early 2000s pop stars. The visual language of the video is so iconic that it's a Halloween costume every year. You can literally chart the teen pop explosion that followed directly back to this one single by this one artist. What makes Baby One More Time a level 7 song is not just that it's huge, it's that from that moment on, Britney is always, in some way, the Baby One More Time girl. Every reinvention she attempts is staged against that image. That song made her famous, and it also created a permanent silhouette. You can be a fan of later eras and resent that, but culturally, its imprint is immovable. Driver's License does a similar, if not so dramatic, thing for Olivia Rodrigo in a completely different ecosystem. It's hard to overstate how fast and completely this song took over. Basically, within a fortnight, Olivia went from the girl from High School Musical, the musical, the series, to the current main character of the internet. This track is an unlikely hit. It's a slow, weirdly structured piano ballad with a bridge that goes nuclear, written from the perspective of a heartbroken 17-year-old circling her ex's street in a car she's barely old enough to drive. It should be a niche internet hit, but instead, it's become a cultural recherche test. Driver's License is a level 7 single because it sets the term of Olivia's entire public persona in one song. Diaristic, hyper-specific, melodramatic in a theater kid way, unafraid of sounding ridiculous in the name of catharsis. I could write a whole essay about how every single lead single she's released since is born in its image. Video Games was Lana Del Rey's one and done. Before that, Lizzie Grant existed in scattered MySpace corners. Here, she steps out onto the main stage, and the character that had been slowly coalescing through years of demos and bar gigs finally emerged fully formed. The song itself is odd for a big breakout, a slow baroque pop ballad. It really shouldn't have worked in the middle of the EDM era global chokehold, and yet it did. The homemade video, sliced together from old Hollywood clips, webcam footage, and paparazzi shots, arrives as the blueprint Lana Del Rey aesthetic, faded Americana, doomed romance, the fantasy being both the ingenue and the doomed housewife. This is a level 7 single because it launched an entire fictional universe that critics and fans are still mapping a decade later. The references to old glamour and decay, the way she sings like she's halfway between seduction and a nervous breakdown, that is Lana Del Rey. I would like to return to Beyoncé again, if you'll take a minute with me here. Crazy in Love, slightly different because it's not a debut in the chronological sense. Beyoncé had already spent years at the top of charts with Destiny's Child, but it is her debut as a solo figure, and it cemented her as a mononym, a person so iconic they could only be known by one name. It was the lead single from Dangerously in Love and her first big statement as an independent entity. This song was meteoric. This song hit number 1 on the Hot 100, it topped charts across the world, won Grammys, and has since been repeatedly crowned as one of the greatest pop songs of all time. The horns, the uh-oh, the Jay-Z feature, those denim shorts and white tank top in the video lodged permanently in our brains. More importantly, Crazy in Love establishes the Beyoncé template, a woman with overwhelming charisma, a preternatural talent for performance and musicality, a genre chameleon, and someone who can make anyone standing next to her look like a lesser star. So that's the ladder. We've gone from singles that shut doors behind an artist to singles that kept the lights on to the few that kick a whole new floor into existence. And again, this is not a morality test for your favorite songs. You are absolutely allowed to love a career killer or hate a reality shifter. What I'm looking at here is not whether the song slaps, it's what it does to an artist's position in the system. A person who drops a level 7 origin myth can survive a couple of level 2 false starts and stabilize with some level 4 safe bets and never reach level 6 again. If you made it this far, first of all, I'm sorry for ranting and raving so much, and second of all, you're welcome. I want to know, which singles do you think I put in the wrong tier? Which ones did I forget entirely? Take the rubric, fight about it in the comments, make your own 7 levels chart, I will be reading, I will be judging, and I will almost certainly be wrong about at least one song you care about.